Today's Takeaway podcast is an extended version of what we normally give you on this podcast version of the Takeaway. It's a full version of our radio program plus some extras. We hope you enjoy it. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and I want you to listen carefully now. With the disturbing developments over the weekend in Dallas, the infection of a healthcare worker, and charges that someone was not following the rules of medical quarantine and isolation, this is another example of something our friend, volunteer Dr. Adam Levine, on the front lines of the Ebola crisis in Liberia, has been trying to tell us for weeks now.
This is a disease that really does almost preferentially target healthcare workers. And that's huge because as a healthcare worker, we sort of have this divide usually between us and our patients. They're the ones that are sick. We're the ones that are healthy. And for so many healthcare workers to be getting infected and to be getting this disease is very unusual.
Ebola preying on healthcare workers. We'll also hear much more from Dr. Levine shortly. He's back from Liberia. We'll get an update from Dallas. Also, gender tensions in the tech world, where Americans went to gawk more than a century ago. Think about that. Where did they go to gawk? It will surprise you on this Columbus Day. And we're coming up in the world, folks. We've got a live band, and you've heard their music before. Hit it, guys. Whoa, I feel like Jimmy Fallon on The Tonight Show. You're hearing the Budos Band. They've composed lots of our interstitial music, and they are here live all hour. It's a Columbus Day holiday live radio treat, and we're very happy about that. Thanks so much, guys, and sit tight there. But we begin with the questions being asked in Dallas, Texas, about how a nurse at the Texas Health Presbyterian Hospital might have been infected with Ebola from treating Thomas Duncan before he died. The CDC reported that this nurse had extensive contact with Duncan, and other top health officials say it could only have happened if some medical protocol was violated. Joining me now from Dallas is Melissa Repko, staff reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Welcome, Melissa.
Thanks for having me.
I suspect the community in Dallas really wants to know the answer to the questions of how this infection could have taken place. What are people saying?
Yes, that's definitely the big question. I was in the neighborhood yesterday where the nurse lived, and most people were concerned about her safety and health and also were worried for the other hospital workers who may have also been exposed to the Ebola virus. Dallas health officials have really been trying to reassure the public that they are not at risk, that to contract Ebola, you must be in direct contact with the bodily fluids of someone who's symptomatic, who's showing symptoms. So they've reassured the public in that way. But for the public, it's concerning to know that someone who is caring for a patient is now ill. So medical investigators will be looking into whether there was a possible problem with protective gear or if a high-risk procedure may have caused exposure or if perhaps the hospital wasn't trained properly to handle such a serious case.
I suspect that the hospital there in Dallas was hoping that this would be behind them with the unfortunate and tragic fatality of Thomas Duncan, but they're going to have this with them for quite a while now.
Yes, unfortunately, it resets the clock because now they will be watching people again and all of the hospital workers in particular very closely as part of that CDC watch. So they're hoping to have no more cases, but the medical investigators will definitely be learning lessons that other hospitals may use going forward to prevent this from happening again.
As was the case with Thomas Duncan, are there any individuals that this nurse was in contact with who are under an armed or forced quarantine at this point?
There is one individual that they believe she had close contact with. The nurse was self-monitoring, so she was taking her temperature twice a day. She was not on the CDC watch list, but she did detect a low-grade fever on Friday night and drove herself to the hospital and was quickly placed in isolation. So it did limit the number of people who were exposed to her when she started to show symptoms. So just one person, and that person is now isolated too.
Melissa Repko, staff reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Many audio diaries from Liberia, Rhode Island ER Dr. Adam Levine has been trying to convey above all else the raw bravery it takes to treat people with Ebola. The raw bravery, he says, of his colleagues who are trying to save their friends and neighbors.
There's just so much stigma associated with the disease, and you know, the fact that these healthcare workers, many of whom have colleagues who've fallen ill or died from the disease, are still here working is really impressive.
Courage and fear is something he says he saw quite literally in the face of his clinic's beloved nurse, Comfort.
We have one patient, Comfort, who's actually an operating room nurse, and she got sick about a week and a half ago. You know, at first she seemed pretty ill. She was having a lot of diarrhea, but now her diarrhea stopped, and she does seem to be getting a little bit better.
Dr. Levine is back in the U.S. after 5 weeks in Liberia. He has a few more days until he's cleared by CDC standards of having become infected with Ebola. So far, so good. He's not too worried, he says, but he is frustrated with the hysteria in the U.S. over such a small group of people infected, when in Liberia the whole medical system is destroyed. Eradicating Ebola, Dr. Levine insists, starts with increasing the focus on the worst-hit areas of West Africa.
From a humanitarian perspective, all of our focus really needs to be on West Africa. That's where thousands of people are dying right now from Ebola. And it's also where this epidemic has taken root and has the chance to spread to other sub-Saharan African countries. And in fact, even from our own personal protection here in America, the best way to stop cases in the future from coming to the U.S. is to eradicate this epidemic right now in West Africa. And we have the opportunity to do that. If we put enough resources into the fight, we can end the epidemic in West Africa and eradicate Ebola for good.
Had you ever done anything like this before when you got on the plane for Liberia?
Well, I guess it depends what you mean by like this. This was my fourth deployment with International Medical Corps as part of their emergency response team. So I've worked in humanitarian emergencies such as after the earthquake in Haiti, in Libya during the conflict there, in South Sudan, working in a refugee camp. So I've done humanitarian work in the past. This was my first time, though, working with Ebola patients and my first time running an Ebola treatment unit.
And in this particular case, it wasn't a conflict zone like Libya and South Sudan. You were really in a place where the battle was against a virus.
That's absolutely right. And it was incredible to me, even our local staff working in the Ebola treatment unit, how often they framed it that way as their fight, as their war against Ebola. And all of them saw themselves in many ways as soldiers on the front lines of that battle.
And in your audio diary, you took such great pains to remind us that this wasn't about you. It was all the courageous people you saw around you, all the people who were putting themselves in harm's way, the people who, you know, would one day be treating people, the next day being a patient. Can you take us back to some of those moments?
Yeah, I mean, one of the most incredible experiences in Liberia was getting the chance to meet and to work really closely with our national staff, the nurses, the physician assistants, the hygienists and the sprayers and the burial team members and all of the local Liberians that helped make our Ebola treatment unit run. So I had the opportunity to help with training them before we opened up our Ebola treatment unit and then working alongside them during the first couple weeks of its operation. And it was incredible to me just how courageous they were. First off, many of them had colleagues and friends who had contracted Ebola and died from Ebola, especially the nurses and the physician assistants. All of them had colleagues or former classmates who had died of Ebola. And then in addition, many of them were being ostracized by their communities. So many of our staff had been kicked out of their homes and their communities because they were working in our Ebola treatment unit. And so they were experiencing this stigma just from working with us, and yet they still came to work, and yet they still showed up, and they were still willing to do the work. And, you know, I was there in Liberia for 5 weeks, and as I said to them on my last day, you know, I get to leave, I get to go home to a place without Ebola, but all of them continued to live in a place with Ebola and continue to work in that going forward.
And what's it like to realize that you might be next, being infected? I mean, you know. That certainly if everyone had colleagues who had died and you're wandering around in the midst of bodies and people who are very, very ill and you take precautions, but still, you know, someone either who you're working with or you yourself could be next.
It's frightening. And, you know, in all cases, whether we're responding to an emergency that's a natural disaster or a conflict or an epidemic such as this, we take all the precautions possible, and you know, our organization, International Medical Corps, takes all the precautions possible to minimize that risk, to mitigate it. And in all of these cases, there are ways you can minimize the risk, but you never minimize it to zero. And it is a risk that you do take, and it can be scary at times. Even after returning here back to the United States, there's still that, you know, 21 days of fear where I'm monitoring my temperature and, you know, 45 seconds of panic every time I put the thermometer in my mouth before it beeps and tells me that I don't have a fever. I think the most abnormal thing about Ebola, what differentiates it for me at least from so many other diseases in sub-Saharan Africa and around the world, is that this is a disease that really does almost preferentially target healthcare workers. And that's huge because as a healthcare worker, we sort of have this divide usually between us and our patients. They're the ones that are sick. We're the ones that are healthy. We're the ones that are strong. We're the ones that are taking care of them. And for so many healthcare workers to be getting infected and to be getting this disease is very unusual compared to most other conditions. It also means a great deal for the weak healthcare systems that already exist in sub-Saharan Africa. When you have a healthcare system where there already are very few doctors and very few nurses, and just a few of them fall ill, it can cause the entire healthcare system to become paralyzed and to collapse. And so that means that all of the other conditions out there don't get treated.
How has your trip home been different from other trips home from foreign assignments with the International Medical Corps?
Well, there's been a lot more publicity this time.
Right.
You know, there is also this weird feeling of, you know, being half hero, half pariah in some ways. It's kind of this strange dichotomy, especially, I think, during this 21-day period after I get back. You know, there's still this sense of, you know, some folks not wanting to see me or be around me. At the same time as I'm getting, you know, more media requests than I can possibly respond to. So it's been very strange in that way, processing it.
Friends don't want to be around you?
There are some, yeah, who have said that they don't want to see me until after 21 days. You know, you have the CDC
in
recommendations.
Boston?
Yeah, in Boston. Some of the same stigma, I guess, that my healthcare workers in Liberia were facing as well.
This so is one of the most educated places in the universe.
Yeah. Well, you know, there is science and there is the Center for Disease Control recommendations and guidelines, which are, you know, very reasonable and evidence-based. And then there's human psychology and there's people's fears. And, you know, this is a disease that generates a lot of fear. And one of my blog posts, I called it an epidemic of fear, actually, because in many ways that's what it is, in addition to an epidemic of a viral disease.
Well, Dr. Adam Levine, we admire your courage, your sense of service, and certainly your willingness to reach out and be a part of our program and to share your stories with all of our listeners. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Adam Levine, an ER physician at the Rhode Island Hospital, also assistant professor of emergency medicine at Brown University.
Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA Craft, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org. And Moo.com, an online print and design company providing software and tools to create business cards, flyers, and triple thick luxe cards. More at Moo.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Last week, a very comfortable-sounding male CEO with a very well-paid gig running Microsoft, Satya Nadella, told a fairly shocked audience at a Women in Computing conference in Phoenix, Arizona, that women in tech will eventually succeed if they just buckle down and do good work, something like that. Well, you can judge for yourself what he actually said. Here's the moment from that conference. Satya Nadella responding to a question.
For women who aren't comfortable with asking for a raise, what's your advice for them?
It's not really about asking for the raise, but knowing and having faith that the system will actually give you the right raises as you go along. And that, I think, might be one of the additional superpowers that, quite frankly, women who don't ask for a raise have. Because that's good karma. It'll come back. Because somebody's going to know that's the kind of person that I want to trust. That's the kind of person that I want to really give more responsibility to. And in the long-term efficiency, things catch up.
The woman asking the questions of CEO Nadella was Maria Clave, president of Harvey Mudd College. In an interview last month, Clave told us that her students are hotly recruited by Microsoft and other top tech companies. President Clave joins us now from Southern California. Welcome again.
Good morning, John.
So, President Clave, I gather that CEO Nadella got all the right raises as he went along. What's wrong with what he said, in your view?
Well, I think Satya would be, his advice is fine if the system really was efficient in rewarding people in terms of their level of contribution. The problem is that, at least in the North American culture, people who ask get more. And it's not just asking for raises, it's asking for more responsibility or asking for a promotion, asking for help. So the reason it was not good advice is that if women are less likely to ask, then they're less likely to be paid well and to get all of the other additional opportunities that come about by asking.
I guess what surprised me, and you have a relationship with Satya Nadella because he recruits your folks there at Harvey Mudd, but it just seemed so completely naive that good karma is what gets rewarded in the tech industry, just being quiet and going along. That's exactly the problem for women in tech.
Yes, well, I think you have to take into account his background. He was definitely raised in a country that believes in good karma and believes in, you know, putting in an effort and expecting that the system, the universe, will reward you for that effort. So, you know, I think you have to take that into account. But also, you know, within a few hours, he had recanted and said he was completely wrong. And I really appreciate that because I don't think there's a lot of CEOs of major tech companies who are as willing to admit that they're wrong when they've made a mistake. And I'm pretty pretty confident at this point that this whole situation is going to result in Satya taking a pretty close look at the issues that face women and other underrepresented groups in the tech industry and do what he can to actually address those issues.
Well, and we're grateful that, you know, you've played a role in this as well. And again, I don't want to kick Nadella around, but, you know, it's interesting because, yes, cultural bias notwithstanding, his sense of being raised in a culture of good karma, I suspect he may have asked for a raise at some point during his career. I don't have any evidence of that. Perhaps you don't either. But it's also the case that men who make it to the place that Nadella has made it don't point to the times they asked for a raise and the times they were annoying and persistent. They point to the fact that, well, the system has rewarded me for being a wonderful, brilliant genius. And that's part of the problem as well. That's sort of the male side.
Yeah, well, I do agree there are many men like that, but it's not Satya. So first of all, he's very humble, and he would never call himself a brilliant genius. The second thing is he actually did talk about during the interview about advice that he got from one of his managers earlier in his career, where it wasn't that he was pushing too hard to get a raise, he was pushing too hard to get the next opportunity. And she basically told him just to focus on his work and do his work well and not to worry about what the next opportunity was going to be. Just be in the present and actually focus on what you're doing and make sure you're doing your best work possible. And that's really, and he says that's the best advice he got. Mm. So his actual belief system about his own situation is actually consistent with what he said. It still doesn't make it right. But he's not being hypocritical.
President Clave, any comments from students at Harvey Mudd you'd like to share?
I've had, well, so first of all, I've had a lot of comments both from our alumni and from our current students that thank me for disagreeing with Satya, which of course I did because I disagree with them. I've also had a lot of comments from students from all across the country thanking Satya for doing the interview and how amazing they thought he was. So, you know, it's always interesting to watch these sort of media firestorm situations. I feel a little bit badly that somebody who made the effort to spend 2 days at this conference and who really genuinely cares about this issue and who, in my opinion and in my experience, is an amazing leader, that he's getting all this flack for you know, one answer to a question when, you know, 95% of his answers were ones that the women who were there thought were just incredible.
Well, we can move on. And as much as I hate this expression, and I suspect you do too, we would have to agree this is one of those teachable moments, right?
Oh, it absolutely is. And I don't even hate that expression as an educator. I love that expression. I think it's a learning opportunity for Satya, certainly, for me, for all of us. And I'm thrilled that this, I mean, even though I feel very badly about all of the flack that Satya's gotten for being honest and then for actually realizing he made a mistake, I do believe we can all learn from it, and it's shining a light on an important issue that faces lots of people.
Well, indeed we will. Maria Clave, president of Harvey Mudd College, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hit it, band. Accompanying us, the Budos Band, all hour long on this Columbus Day. And as we talk about Columbus Day on the program, we're asking questions about how your relatives arrived when they came to North America. They didn't come on the Nina, the Pinta, or the Santa Maria, I suspect. But you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and be a part of the conversation. You don't hear so much about it in these days of Ebola headlines, but a much more urgent public health crisis in America is Alzheimer's and dementia. Treating it and addressing its anticipated costs to society as people age. By 2050, it's predicted that almost two-thirds of folks who make it past 85 will have some form of the disease. One real barrier to progress in research is the difficulty of testing treatments without using human subjects. That barrier may have been surmounted, though, by replicating Alzheimer's in a petri dish. The work's been carried out at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. And for the first time, doctors were able to reproduce in a controlled environment the full course of events underlying the development of Alzheimer's disease in nerve tissue. Murali Doraswamy joins us now. He's the author of the Alzheimer's Action Plan and professor of psychiatry at Duke University Medical Center. Murali, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
What is really important about this breakthrough, and do you think it's going to be confirmed?
I think this is a major breakthrough for the field because, as you pointed out, Alzheimer's is a huge public health problem. We don't fully understand its causes, and we don't have a way to either cure it, halt it, or to prevent it. And the last 10 years, more than 20 different treatments have failed in clinical trials. And the reason they failed is partly because we don't understand what causes Alzheimer's, and our animal models of Alzheimer's are imperfect. So having a better model of Alzheimer's in a petri dish will allow us to test drugs much more rapidly at a fraction of the cost.
And have other diseases found treatments using this kind of petri dish modality?
Yes, and but it's still early days, and one of the approach to creating a dish, a disease in a dish, is through the use of what's called a stem cells. Stem cells are cells that have the potential to mature into almost any kind of tissue, and in this particular experiment, they used stem cells from an individual who had a strong history of familial early onset Alzheimer's, and then they were able to nudge these cells to becoming nerve cells, and then to eventually to reproduce all of the Alzheimer's pathology in a petri dish. So this is probably one of the closest models that we have to what actually happens in the human brain.
Would the tissue here all be from one genetic strain, or could you design custom treatments based on individual tissue cultures from individual patients?
Ultimately, that would be the hope. We're not there yet, but I think right now the goal is to rapidly screen thousands of potential treatments using this one person. But then you could also mix and match cells from multiple individuals. So I could imagine a lab having 1,000 different petri dishes, each one hosting a disease from one individual's family. And then you could screen different drugs to see which one works in which particular individual. So that would be really the holy grail of personalized treatment.
Is there a particular drug, a particular molecule that's ahead of the pack in terms of the possible treatments?
Right now, there are 4 large prevention trials underway, and they are targeting a type of pathology in the Alzheimer's brain called amyloid plaque buildup. We think that this is what triggers Alzheimer's. We're not yet sure, but these plaques build up around nerve cell tissue, and they jam communications, they induce inflammation in the brain, and they induce other kinds of cell damage. So this particular initial trigger is what is being targeted by several different drug treatments right now.
And drugs to either prevent or to eradicate that amyloid plaque is really the central focus right now of research. Dr. Murali Doraiswamy, thanks so much.
It's a pleasure.
He's the author of The Alzheimer's Action Plan and professor of psychiatry at Duke University Medical Center. Columbus Day, and happy Columbus Day, is a holiday that commemorates a very ancient event back in 1492, but it's a holiday that stirs up some very unsettled issues in North America. It became a federal holiday in 1972 on the 480th anniversary of the Columbus landing in the New World. A strange anniversary to celebrate, but it was also an election year, and perhaps then-President Richard Nixon was going after Italian-American votes. Now, Native Americans, who don't consider themselves part of any new world, thank you very much, have understandably limited enthusiasm for a holiday dedicated to an event that led to the destruction of their way of life. Over the last few decades, some states and a few cities have decided to rename the holiday from Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day, and this year, the city of Minneapolis will celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day for the first time. Joining us are activists who made that happen in Minneapolis. Peggy Flanagan, executive director of the Children's Defense Fund of Minnesota, who serves on the board of the Native American Community Development Institute. She's also an enrolled member of the White Earth Band of the Ojibwa. Also with us is Daniel Yang, director of organizing and community building for the Native American Community Development Institute. Daniel and Peggy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
Thanks so much.
So what is your intent here, Peggy, and what will people do today that would be different from what they would normally do on Columbus Day?
Well, today it's a day to celebrate Indigenous people, the Native folks who are here in this country. And in the city of Minneapolis, we have a long, rich history of an urban American Indian community. Today we will gather at the Minneapolis American Indian Center. Mayor Betsy Hodges will be there, Senator Al Franken, and hundreds of community members celebrating who we are as Indigenous people, and the fact that we are still here, we weren't discovered, and just acknowledging our community.
Is there any tension with Italian Americans in the Twin Cities? Many Italian Americans view Columbus Day as a nationalistic holiday, a celebration of Italian American values.
So far, at least conversations with folks in the community have been fairly positive. Just again, acknowledging a community that is still here, that we still exist, and you know we see it as a positive thing, and so far the response generally from folks in Minneapolis has been positive. Again, you know, I don't necessarily think that this takes away from Italian Americans. There are certainly other folk from Italy and descendants of that should be celebrated versus someone who, frankly, started in many senses the genocide of a people. So we think that there are probably things in the community that should be lifted up a little bit more, and this is just a great way to honor folks who've been here for generations.
Daniel Yang, is it fair for Columbus to take this rap of starting something that became genocide in that there were a lot of decisions made by Americans, by Europeans here in North America, in the United States? It didn't have to turn out the way that it did in the U.S. There could have been much more of a coexistence, don't you think?
Peggy touched on it a little bit, but this really was, if it wasn't necessarily Columbus alone, this was the moment in history that began all of this hurt. And so it's a hurt that goes back generations. And so when it's that first moment, when it's your relatives, it might not be directly in your bloodline, but other relatives, Indigenous peoples throughout North and South America, where the beginning of disease, of rape, of murder occurs. And you're correct that this continues on. But this serves as a moment to celebrate Indigenous people
Daniel Yang is Director of Organizing and Community Building for the Native American Community Development Institute in the Twin Cities. Peggy Flanagan is Executive Director of the Children's Defense Fund of Minnesota. She serves on the board of the Native American Community Development Institute and is an enrolled member of the White Earth Band of the Ojibwe. Peggy, thanks so much. And Daniel, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Thanks, Sean.
Where do you go to gawk these days? It's probably not to a rope line in the middle of the street where you can stand in a black suit and stare at primitive people making a communal meal out of a cooked dog. Stay with me here. You can find hundreds of thousands of hits on YouTube, videos of people eating dog in East Asia, but far more hits of scantily clad celebrities or cute babies these days. Today we gawk in the privacy of our own homes, online. But in the ancient pre-internet days of the late 1800s, people's hunger to gawk at the primitive led to a popular form of entertainment. In New York City in the year 1905, millions of well-dressed Americans attended the display of a tribe of scantily clad Filipino natives who traveled halfway around the world to amuse visitors to Coney Island's Luna Park by performing ceremonial rituals, eating dogs, and just being themselves. The show was put together by Truman Hunt, and the story of how he came to exhibit an entire tribe is the subject of Claire Prentice's new book, The Lost Tribe of Coney Island, Headhunters, Luna Park, and the Man Who Pulled Off the Spectacle of the Century. Prentice says Truman Hunt saw how he could make the headhunting, dog-eating Igorot tribe the most famous celebrities in the world.
They'd first come to St. Louis in 1904, and they had been amongst a huge group of Filipinos who had come. There were 1,300 of them from 12 different tribes. And the Igorots, who are in my book, Bontoc Igorots, to use their full name, had been by far the most popular of the tribes who'd been to St. Louis because they were extraordinarily outgoing, seemed natural performers, and also they captivated the American public for three main reasons. They wore hardly any clothes. They wore just G-strings. They had tattoos on their bodies. Also, they ate dog. And back in the Philippines, they hunted human heads, which was thrilling and scandalized the public.
And when Americans were staring at these folks in the exhibit halls and places in Coney Island where you would just stand and look at them, it wasn't simply voyeurism. It was also an issue of America's connection at that time with the Philippines because of our colonial war, the Spanish-American War.
That's right. And the showman, Truman Hunt, who brought them, had been given permission to bring them to America, and largely because America had recently colonized the Philippines, and it was in America's interest to show the public up close just how savage, in inverted commas, these people were, that they had much to learn from their colonizers, that they could learn to be civilized. And yes, I mean, it was anthropological, it was entertainment, it was sensation, but it also was political.
It was a message of nation building. That the U.S. can do this in the Philippines and look at how we will benefit these individuals here.
That's very true, yeah.
You say in a very compelling moment in part of your introduction that you wanted to get into the minds of these tribesmen and to figure out why it is they left their home and what it is they felt like in the pictures that you saw of them being gawked at by people, you know, hours and hours and hours on end. Were you ever able to do that?
Yeah, well, this whole thing started for me with a photograph. I went out to Coney Island on a day trip. I'd been living in New York working as a journalist and came across a picture of these people, tribesmen, women and children, and I just was fascinated by them. There was something about them that drew me in, and I immediately knew I had to find out who they were, why and when they'd been brought here and what had become of them. And it's just amazing to me. You know, they were a national sensation in 1905. And 100 years later, they've been completely forgotten about. And yeah, in reading about them, I've read court testimonies, I got a very good insight into them and into what their experience was.
In your obsession, it seems as though these tribesmen and the story and their spell on America electrified you almost in the same way as it electrified Mr. Hunt, in a sense. You both get turned on for different reasons, but but it becomes an obsession for him as well. He seems like a very classic American character.
Yeah, he's a huckster. He seems at the beginning of the story to be their friend, and as the story goes on, he's revealed to be a much darker character. I don't want to give too much away from the book, but he is the man who is trusted by the tribe. They look up to him. They regard him as a friend. They make him a very rich man. He's spending the money they're earning him faster than they can earn it. He had promised to pay them each $15 a month in wages. He doesn't give them a penny of it. And he becomes very greedy. And he's a very interesting man.
And he believed that the U.S. could do great things in the Philippines. He truly believed it.
Absolutely, yeah.
What happened as far as assimilation was concerned? I mean, were any of the tribesmen, any of the people in this story able to make it? I mean, there's a translator who kind of steps over into both worlds, but what about some of the others?
Well, the translator you mentioned, Julio Balanag, he is, to begin with, the most seemingly American of them all. He wears American clothes where all the other ones wear G-strings. He really believes in the American dream. He wants to make it in America. The group in my story, they have such a bad experience in the end. They're exploited terribly. They have a very unhappy time. They're taken on the road, end up living in squalor. They, by the end of it, were happy. They were given the option of going back to the Philippines or of staying in America, and they all went back. They didn't want to stay on. The American dream had turned sour for them. Later, this was a trade, the Igorot show trade, that went on for 10 years. And in later years, there were examples of other tribesmen, mostly men, who did stay on and who did make lives for themselves, one of whom was a chap, James Robert Amok, and he actually went on to fight in the war and was declared an American hero. So there were some happy stories that came out of this, but there was a lot of sadness for them too.
Claire Prentice is the author of The Lost Tribe of Coney Island, Headhunters, Luna Park, and The Man Who Pulled Off the Spectacle of the Century. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the Igorot were packed up and brought to America from the Philippines, and they didn't stick around. How about your relatives? What's their story? From Irving, Texas, my great-grandfather was a stowaway on a ship from Germany in the late 19th century, came with nothing, but did just fine, according to family legend.
This is Nikki Allenbast from Kirkland, Washington. My beloved late father-in-law arrived in the United States from a circuitous path. John was born in the Dutch East Indies in 1936, then taken into Japanese prison camp with his family for a number of years. After liberation, they were flown to Australia to recover. Next came a return to Holland, then immigration to Canada. Finally, the quotas opened to allow his family to realize their dream of coming to America to stay when he was a teenager.
Thanks, Nikki. Great story. Tell us another, won't you? Call 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's our number. Much more at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, we'll talk with the Budos Band. You've been hearing their music all this hour. Stay with us. Welcome back to the very live takeaway. This is John Hockenberry, and I feel like, I've been reincarnated in a dream of Frank Zappa and Henry Mancini here. I'm here with the Budos Band. That's a track from their latest album, Burnt Offering, which is out later this month. Welcome to Jared Tankel and Brian Profilio. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Yeah. And can you announce, just introduce the rest of the members of the band, since you're all out there, right, guys?
Yeah.
We got a full studio here.
We got Bobby Chipette on the congas, Robert Lombardo.
Excellent.
Dan Fodor on the bass, Thomas Brennick. playing the guitar, Michael Deller playing keyboards, Farfisa, and Andy Green, the doc, playing trumpet.
And this isn't even the full, like, complement of Buddha's.
True. We're missing a couple, two guys that don't live in New York anymore.
This is a seven Buddha gig, not a nine Buddha gig. Yeah. All right. Well, it's great to have you here, and I love your sound. Can you tell me a little bit about where that sound comes from? It's very noir sounding, but it's also got this West African thing going here as well.
Yeah. I mean, we originally started off as an Afrobeat band, so we were playing long instrumental versions or long instrumental Afrobeat songs, and we realized that the instrumental songs needed to be shorter. Having a 15-minute long song was just, it wasn't working.
And doing live radio, they really need to be shorter, yeah. So we're really helping you out with
right,
that.
We could have wrote a bunch
of exactly. Right.
But we just crunched them down, and I gave them more of like a popular American-style format, which is verse, chorus, and just crunched them down to like 3 or 4 minutes, so it's just the juicy parts, in a sense.
And we've been using your music as interstitial music on our show since the very beginning, and that's really, I mean, you've been riding that for like 7 years now, right? How's that been working for you?
I mean, we're here, so
yeah. Exactly, the pinnacle, the peak,
yeah.
I notice in my prep stuff here that, Jared, you are also a lawyer.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And Brian, you are also a New York City public school art teacher.
Yeah.
It says about Tom Brannick, he's just the guitar player. Guitar players never have a day gig, and they're always the only ones wearing sunglasses. You had sunglasses on before, right, Tom?
Yeah.
So lawyer by day, is that right?
Some days, yeah. Some of the day.
When you make it in?
Yeah. Okay. Today, for example, not so much of the lawyer day.
Yeah, well, it's a pro bono thing you're doing for us here. That's beautiful. That's beautiful. And you would be teaching by this time, right?
Yeah. Waking up this early wasn't really...
It's not early.
Oh, well, we woke up...
Any time during the day. This show plays any time during the day.
We woke up in Weehawken, John.
Oh, okay. That's a ferry away.
Whoa.
That's great. And you didn't know where you were, right? Hangover 3. Yes. Right, exactly. Well, happy Columbus Day. So, with this new album, Burnt Offering, are you doing anything that's different from your sound, the sound that we've heard on this show, Brian?
Oh, no, you heard probably about 4 or 5, 6 maybe songs off the Burn Offering album, but the songs on the record are totally different than style-wise and aesthetically than the first 3 albums. So it's fun. They're
new stuff, experimenting. Yeah. Yep, that's good. You've got the baritone sax right there.
Jeremy.
Okay, what's the lowest note you can play? See, this is just for me.
Hit him.
Forget the audience. Forget the radio audience.
Yeah.
I don't care.
If it took the ferry.
Yeah. Nice. Oh, just love that. I got an alto, and I'm terrible at it.
I had to melt that down because it just didn't.
You melted it down with the baritone.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, exactly.
It took
exactly.
up like a quarter of the bell.
Are you gigging regularly in the New York area?
Well, we have a show coming up in Brooklyn next Saturday, which is our record release, or 2 Saturdays from now, which is our record release party. We play in New York 3-4 times a year, something like that, you know.
Mostly traveling?
We travel a decent amount, though, too. We get out to the West Coast a couple times a year, do the Midwest a couple times, every once in a while hop over to Europe. We do have other gigs that we do some of the time, but when
it's
we can't
like
get
us.
Away.
We you know, tour around, you know, occasionally hop over to Europe. We haven't done that for 3 years. but we'd love to hop over to Syria maybe and do some news over there. Yikes. Oh, my goodness. So what do you teach, Brian?
Drawing.
Drawing.
Art.
Okay. That kind of art. Drawing art. Okay. And did they ask you about the drums?
Most kids have no idea. That I'm in a band, and if they found out, they really wouldn't care. Like, this kind of music is just not interesting to a 15-year-old kid for the most part.
You can't do Anaconda or anything. anything that's relevant.
I mean, it's like, oh, that's cool, mister, but they don't care, really. Like, they're not going to go buy the album. They're not going to come to the shows.
Right? You might as well play the harpsichord or something.
Yeah, right?
They know what buying an album is.
Right? Yeah, they don't know. Yeah, exactly. No. Right. Buying an album. What?
Weird.
How adorable. I hear, as I said in the intro, I hear Zappa in this band. I mean, he's not as fast as Zappa on the guitar, but I hear a kind of, you know, peaches in regalia kind of horn stuff.
He's the Zappa fan.
Yeah? The trumpet player is a Zappa fan?
Yeah.
Excellent.
I mean, I think, you know, we're taking a whole bunch of different influences and cramming them into what we do. So if Zappa makes his way in there a little bit, I wouldn't be surprised. But, you know, anywhere from psychedelic 70s rock to, you know, Nigerian funk, it's sort of...
Oh, we love that. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE if you hear any Zappa in the song they are about to play. Run along, boys, to your positions here, and we'll have a cut here to take us out. This is The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. This is the Budos Band, their latest album, Burnt Offering. Thanks so much for listening to all of you. And you can, of course, be a part of this conversation or clap along with the band by going to thetakeaway.org. Here's the Budos, bro.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
Public Radio International.